We imagine North Korea as a country that is carrying on not only a conflict left over from the Cold War, but also a decrepit legacy economy from the past. So when recent travelers reported seeing digital billboards at shopping malls in Pyongyang, it caught many international observers by surprise. Moreover, we see everyday people in Pyongyang using cell phones on the street. We've known for a while that USB sticks are used to smuggle South Korean pop culture content into North Korea. So we knew that some North Koreans had computer devices. But what has become more evident in recent years is the extent to which mobile technology has been embraced not just illicitly by the North Korean people, but also formally by the state as part of its economic plan. Our guest today has been looking into the evolution of cell phone adoption in North Korea and how it has been changing society, particularly in the economic space where mobile technology has revolutionized the nascent private sector. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Yeonho Kim is our non-resident fellow at KEI, and he's the author of the recent groundbreaking report titled North Korea's Mobile Telecommunication and Private Transportation Services in the Kim Jong-un Era. It was published by the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just jump right into your report. It's rich in detail, and I think it's going to surprise a lot of readers when they engage with the report. Firstly, I mean, we tend to think of North Korea as a backwards country that is completely isolated from modern technology. I think the imagery that people have is of people starving, industries that are from the 1980s. But your report, and also which is confirmed by a lot of recent international travelers to North Korea, suggests that there is a proliferation of mobile technology in North Korea, and also potentially the rise of new services like e-commerce as well on top of that. This isn't something that can be built, you know, overnight. So would you be able to tell the listeners about how this began and who the actors are that are building it? Was it the Chinese? Who's responsible for this sudden change in North Korea?
So this telecommunication technology, you wouldn't expect that kind of things going on in a country like North Korea, but they have been investing in this specific sector for a long time. So the North Korea first got their commercial mobile telecom service in 2002, way long ago. It was introduced by a Thailand telecom company, Luxley Pacific. And first the service was introduced in Pyongyang and Rajin Sambong, now we call it Rasan. It's a special economic zone, a border city where you can see not only North Korea, but also China and Russia. They actually did a good job. It was a 2G service, and it expanded the coverage area to Nampo, Kaesong, and other provincial capitals and major highways. And by the end of 2003, the number of subscribers was estimated at around 20,000. Not that big number, but when you think about the situation in North Korea, it was quite a good number. But something really shocking happened in 2004. There was a massive explosion at Yongcheon train station in North Pyongan province.
Right, this was when people thought it was a potential assassination attempt, right?
Right. Their leader, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father. At the time, the security agency speculated that the bombing was, in a way, remotely controlled by a wireless handset. So probably a cell phone played a big role here. So that's why the authorities decided to ban all cell phones across the country, and they actually started to confiscate all cell phone devices. But suddenly in December 2008, 4 years after the Yongcheon incident, North Korea, they lifted the ban on cell phones and reintroduced the cell phone service. And this time it was a 3G service, upgraded service. And their partner was an Egyptian telecom company, Orascom. Again, it's a joint venture. And Orascom got like 25-year business license. So pretty much very privileged conditions for this Egyptian company at the time.
Why the sudden lift? Is there any indication why the North Korean government changed their mind in 2008?
We can easily think the situation the North Korean leadership was in at the time. I think the leadership was facing huge political pressure because they were supposed to complete, or at least start to complete, a strong and prosperous nation by 2012. So they thought, I think, strong nation, well, you have nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, so you can claim you are strong. But what about prosperity part? They have been pursuing self-reliant economy and a centrally planned economy, which don't work at all. So to claim they're prosperous by 2012, they desperately needed some kind of outside help, like foreign investment. South Korea will be the best candidate, but that doesn't make sense. You're claiming prosperous nation through the help of your arch enemy. So they looked around, and Orascom at the time, they just volunteered to help North Korea. Orascom was very famous for their business practice of choosing high-risk country for high returns. Orascom thought North Korea would be the best business partner at the time. And they also invested a huge amount of money in other areas, like Ryugyong Hotel. Remember the pyramid-like hotel? Yeah. For a long time, it was left as a cement structure, and the building project was just stopped because of lack of money. But Orascom put some money so that they can put glasses outside the hotel. We don't know what's going on inside the hotel, but at least from outside, people can easily see this hotel wherever you're in Pyongyang, and this kind of landmark in Pyongyang. So the Pyongyang citizens would be proud of that. And also Orascom invested in cement factories, so it was really a great help for North Korea, for them, while they are pursuing prosperous nation.
You mentioned that when that Thailand company first came in, only 20,000 people subscribed to a cell phone service. For a country that's approximately 15 to 20 million people, 20,000 doesn't seem like an embodiment of prosperity. Was it different with Orascom? Were there more subscribers when Orascom came in 2008?
Yeah, absolutely. There has been a really dramatic subscriber growth since Orascom launched their service in late 2008. So the number of subscribers increased dramatically and now estimated at around 4 million. Yeah, so that means at least 2 out of every 10 North Koreans is using cell phone, which is great phenomenon to see from the outsiders. But the exact number of subscribers is now anyone's guess, because Orascom has stopped reporting the number after the number reached 3 million in late 2015. But time to time, we have some news report on that number, because the South Korean National Intelligence Service time to time report the situation, specifically this Orascom situation, to the intelligence committee people at the National Assembly in Korea. And a couple of intelligence committee congressmen, they just release the number to the reporter. So that's how we get time to time the estimates. And also, North Korea introduced the second cell phone service provider, and it is wholly owned by the North Korean government under the brand name of Pyeol. It means star in Korean, and it is estimated at around 1 million subscribers. So all in all, around 5 million, that's our best guess, but there's no way we can verify the number.
Right, so about potentially around a quarter at least of the population has cell phone service. That's a remarkable, I think, change to how people usually perceive North Korea as kind of a technologically backwards country. This is quite surprising. But I also want to touch upon perhaps what is most surprising about your report with the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, which is the impact that cell phone services has had on how people interact with one another in the black market. North Korea's black market, also known as Jangmadang, has been kind of the lifeblood of how the fragile North Korean economy sustains itself. And you wrote in the report the revolutionary changes that came with cell phone services. Would you be able to describe some aspects of the changes that took place?
Yeah, there are a lot of things going on. But first of all, I want to emphasize that the cell phones have changed people's daily life in North Korea. So for the average citizen, the price of phones and the service fees are still quite burdensome. That's true. But cell phones have become one of the most noticeable examples of conspicuous consumption. So people are trying to show off their social status, even if it doesn't really reflect their real situation, by having cell phones. So in North Korea, it is impossible to find a girlfriend without a cell phone. That's kind of a must. It's like how cars works for the youngsters in America. And the mobile phone has also changed, as you mentioned, the way merchants do business. And they are now able to collect the real-time market information like prices, exchange rates, quantity of goods they are looking for, and promptly respond to the changing market conditions. So the negotiations are now taking place over the phone instead of meeting at the marketplace in person. And the merchants can make decisions over the phone on price, quantity, shipping, and delivery methods. And so that's why you can no longer imagine doing business without cell phone in North Korea.
Do we see that this has led to an expansion of market activity on Jangmadang?
First of all, meeting in person takes time. But again, with cell phone, you can instantly have all information you want as long as you have the cell phone numbers of your business partners. And you don't even have to move around with your goods to sell. There are even truck or bus drivers who provide courier service. We don't have FedEx or UPS service in North Korea, but they have their own North Korean-style courier service going on now. So all they need is the shipper and recipient's cell phone numbers, and this courier service allows the merchants to do business while sitting at home. You don't have to move around. So they don't need to visit the seller or buyer or even travel to another city. So in the past, we call them runner merchant who just carry their goods and meet the people who need the goods they're carrying. But now we call them stay-at-home merchant. So all they need is cell phone numbers and tell the people where to go, who to meet, at what prices.
Wow. And, I think you just touched upon the other major development in the North Korean economy that you touch on in your report, which is the proliferation of private transportation services that stem from the availability of mobile communication. But foremost, what kind of demand is this fulfilling? What happened to public transportation? Why can't merchants rely on trains and public buses? What happened to the public transportation network that led merchants to rely on the courier services that you just mentioned?
Right. So North Korea's transportation system traditionally centered on railway. And Kim Il-sung once stated, railways are the arteries of the country. So it's still the most important transportation method in North Korea. But since the 1990s economic crisis, the railway system is not working well. Lack of energy, electricity, and deterioration of locomotives and railway tracks. So that's why I think North Korea wants to have some kind of cooperation to upgrade their roads and railway with South Korea nowadays. So rail system is not reliable for the merchants. It goes as slow as around 20 kilometers per hour, stop frequently. You don't know when you can get to the destination. All you can do is just be persistent and patient and pray a lot. So usually the one-day trip theoretically extends to a several-day adventure in North Korea. That's a very common thing. So that's why people started to think about having their own private ground transportation methods, because we have demand of people and product movement as the marketization grows. And the marketization is kind of a survival tactic. So it's very urgent need. So that's why we came up with a service cha, a combination of two words, service and cha, meaning car in Korean. So service cha expanded from freights, military trucks, to buses, vans, all types of vehicles, even motorcycles you can think of. And that really satisfied the various demands of the market for the short and long distance travel.
It sounds like the nascent version of a North Korean Uber, almost, if you're using cell phone technology, the new cell phone technology, to call a car service to carry your goods. But the other thing that's really interesting about the rise of these private transportation services is that North Korea is also notorious for not allowing its citizens to move freely between cities. I mean, you need permits. There's a lot of regulatory barriers for people and goods to travel within the country. How do these servichas get around this regulatory burden of having to deal with all these barriers to transportation?
In one sentence, I would say, as long as you have enough money, you can buy the freedom. Freedom is for sale. There's a good chance to buy the freedom there. So corruption actually helped the development of servicha. So in order to operate servicha, people must register their cars or motorcycles under state institutions like factories, enterprises, military bases. And as you said, private ownership of vehicles in North Korea is banned. So that's how they can operate their servicha legally. So ownership is with the state institution, but everybody knows who the owner is. And the officials, the corrupted officials, they can secure operational funds of their institution by collecting like a monthly fee from the servicha owners, and also some kind of a bribe accumulating their private wealth. And the servicha owners, in return for that, they can quote-unquote legally operate their vehicles in the market.
And is this also how these vehicles will also procure fuel? Is it they get it from state-owned enterprises and military bases? They would just bribe officials there for fuel?
That's kind of a positive aspect of corruption, if you will. So the gas stations, they're run by the state. But you don't have that many gas stations in North Korea, mainly concentrated in downtown Pyongyang, the capital city, and its suburbs and provincial capitals. So if you're traveling countryside, you really need illegal traders. And they get their fuel from China and Russia, a smuggled one. If you're rich enough, you can do that. Smaller scale illegal traders, they got their fuel from military bases, oil reservoirs, factories, or enterprises. So all corrupted business going on here. So the military bases appropriate fuel by fabricating their training time, and the enterprises sell fuel received from the state to the market and buy back from the market when they really need it to port back to the state.
That's an incredibly complicated system, but it's also amazing that from this complexity, we have this burgeoning of a private market in North Korea. There are so many other private enterprises that have been made possible in the Kim Jong-un era, and you mentioned a lot of them in your report. Could you speak on some of the other business services that are new in the Kim Jong-un era that, much like the servichas, rely on cell phone technology to operate? Money couriers. Would you speak on money couriers as another example?
The combination of servicha and cell phones led to a new method of private money transfer, because people in North Korea, they don't trust the banking system there. They do have central bank and the state-run bank branches throughout the country. But once you make deposit there, there's practically no way you can get it back. You can make a request, but the officials at the bank would say, well, you have to be patient, meaning you will never get the money back, or if you provide some bribe, then there's a better chance for you to get the money back. So people don't rely on the official banking system. That's how this private money transfer system came in. The servicha drivers, they take the money from sender to the recipients and take some transfer fees. We call it the iguanbi, or the money transferred, they call it iguandon in Korean. Because of the stay-at-home business, you have a larger cargo traded and transported. So the settlement costs are getting higher than before. And how do you pay back in cash? Servicha drivers, they have a very long-term business relationship with the shippers and recipients. So they don't want to ruin the relationship, and also they want to keep their credibility. And also technology makes sure there is a correct delivery of the money. So the sender have the recipient's cell phone number. So as soon as the truck driver delivers the money to the recipient, you can instantly confirm whether the amount is the same as the amount you sent.
Mm-hmm.
So there's little chance for drivers to play a game here.
That's incredible that just having cell phone technology has made all these different services possible. You mentioned at the very beginning of your analysis that part of what may have triggered the state turning the other cheek and allowing all this private enterprise to take place is the state's promise of a strong and prosperous nation. With that in place, do these entrepreneurs face any risks? I mean, it sounds like everything is working not efficiently, but it seems like there is a operational protocol in place where they have a long-term personal relationship with someone in the state apparatus. They pay bribes. They maintain these very informal relationships. Like, what is the biggest risks facing entrepreneurs in this environment currently?
I think you just answered the question. So you always have to make a deal with the people at checkpoints and the state institutions where you register vehicles. A lot of risks are at the checkpoints because the state institutions you're working with, you have a long-term relationship. So as long as anything unexpected happens, you're fine with them. But checkpoints, it doesn't matter whether you abide by all regulations. It's impossible for a service to pass through the checkpoints without offering bribes. You also periodically bribe the guards and the officials there, but sometimes they just demand, for whatever reason, more bribes. And in North Korea, people call the bribe homework. So you don't do the homework, you're a bad person there. So you have low morals at checkpoints. So you have to do your homework, and there's no way you can expect exactly how much homework you have to do. So that's a kind of big risk for the service owners and operators. So if you are just detained at the checkpoints for not doing your homework, then you cannot make the delivery on time. In this kind of business situation, you know, credibility is really important in North Korea nowadays. So that's basically one of the way ruining your credibility.
Right. So like corruption has both allowed private enterprise to take place, but also is the biggest risk factor at the same time.
Right.
Maybe to close out, I want to end with a question that I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds, which is, you know, looking back on the last 10 years on major social movements around the world, such as the Arab Spring or even Occupy Wall Street in Europe and the United States, we saw that connectivity through mobile devices led to mobilization of popular dissent. Protests occur because people found the event on Facebook. They share dissident materials over Twitter, over Weibo. Social media and networking has been attributed as the key variable in social protest. Could this take place in North Korea?
There has been no Korean Spring, unfortunately. There's no signs that the regime introduced cell phones as a means of reforming or opening up their society. Rather, the cell phones are seen as expressions of the regime's confidence in its ability to control the people and monitor their mobile communications. For example, the region managed the pace and scale of mobile telecom service in a very measured way. The North Koreans are not allowed to get access to the internet. International calls and data transfers are blocked. And I was told recently they resumed data transfer service. But that means, again, the regime is confident that they can control, monitor all the data transfers. So if you just text or say something really politically sensitive, especially criticizing the supreme leader, it can be easily picked up by the security agency, and that's going to be ruining your career or the safety of your whole family. So people are pretty much accustomed to that kind of situation. Whether it is technologically making sense or not doesn't matter. People just assume the regime is really capable of monitoring their communications. So there are really voluntary self-censorships are going on there. In that kind of situation, I don't think there's a big chance North Korean Spring or North Korean style Jasmine Revolution will be happening in the near future.
That is it for our episode today. Many thanks to Yeonho Kim for coming on the show, and to you listeners for tuning in. You can find Yeonho Kim's piece on the website of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. You will find the link in the description of this episode. If you have any questions or comments, send us a tweet at KoreaEconInst. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page and YouTube channel where you can stream our events live. Our next event is on the role of sanctions relief in negotiations with North Korea with Daniel Wirtz from the National Committee on North Korea on April 9th from noon to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. See you there.